Hi there, I'm Amy Griffiths and I'm one of the journalists in Max Radio's newsroom. And on this episode of Newscast, we're celebrating the latest recipients of the King's Birthday Honours. We're going to be hearing from sports journalist John Watterson, who's been made an MBE, Karen Norton, who's a BEM, as well as Dr. Stephen Quilliam, who's also received a BEM. But first, let's hear from the very Reverend Nigel Godfrey, who's received an MBE.
It has to be seen in the context, really, of being a corporate award that can only be given to an individual, it seems to me, because I represent both the church and the community, and it's really about my engagement with the community, and it's the community and the church that have enabled the activities that have been brought about to happen, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, and one of those activities was obviously you were instrumental in the rejuvenation of the cathedral, I suppose. What does it mean for you to be, I suppose, recognised for that work there? Is that something that you're particularly proud of, or is there other things that, you know, really stand out to you?
I'm not really sure how to answer the question, because in a way it's my vocation has been in the church to engage with the community and to engage with the people who I find myself living amongst, and so it's really I hope has been something about releasing the skills and the gifts of people in the community and in the church that they already have, and getting them to share with that for the greater good of the community. That's how I see it anyway.
So would you say this award goes to everyone? They're not...
They can't give it to everyone, because the very nature of the award is that it's given to an individual. But actually, I can only see it really in the context of so many people that have enabled things to happen, be it the work at the cathedral or the work in Brixton before I came to the island. Having said that, of course, I am Manx, but having returned to the island, let's put it that way. So it's for me, I see it as an honour for the community and for the church, not for me particularly.
Oh, well, that's amazing.
I haven't seen the what do they call it, the document that actually states what this award is for. I have no idea who put me forward, and so I'm kind of in a bit in the dark in the whole process, and certainly it was a shock to me. I had no clue that it was happening.
When did you find out?
I think it was when the governor asked me was it a week or so ago? I think it was about then. That my name had somehow appeared. I don't know. I have no clue about the process.
Well, it's a great privilege, Darren. Yeah, totally out of the blue, to be honest. I had no idea about it until His Excellency contacted me a few weeks ago before the TT. So I've had to keep you quiet since then, but it's not been easy. But it's a great privilege, and I'm really honoured.
When you look back at your career, is there any highlights that maybe stick out to you as to why you've been given this award, or that you're just particularly proud of as well?
I think, to be fair, the one word you describe my career is longevity. I think the fact that, you know, I was involved and still am involved in newspapers for 52 years now, colossal really. I always had that sort of goal for 50 years, you know, in the last decade, sort of through the COVID years, and I thought, oh, it'd be nice to finish at 50 years. And then I've been working part-time, but I mean, just last 3 weeks at the TT, I've been working full-time, and it's still great to be involved. I've seen many changes in the industry, you know, from when I started with hot metal and the old industry, and going through all that period, then in the early stages of the new wave of the industry, the new style of newspapers, and then of course the later, you know, the digital image, digital age, really, that's the big change, and in some respect detrimental to newspapers, because we aren't as popular as we were, but it's still a great industry to be part of. And that's what I take away from it, is the people I've worked with and the people I've had the privilege to report on over the years, because you know, I've been very fortunate certainly in the last 30 odd years, is this sport has really taken off globally. But in the Isle of Man, you know, it's an amazing now, the success that we have at the international level, which was never there before. And it's great to be a part of that, really. Yeah, well, thank you to the people. I know there's been some nice testimonials to me, and people not just involved with sport, but other people locally have said some nice things about me, which is, I really do appreciate. And I really enjoyed my years. It's been a lifestyle. Covering sport particularly has been a lifestyle, because it's something that nearly all sport takes place at weekends, and you have to adapt your life to suit, really. And much of the sport that I've covered over the years has been a Sunday afternoon or a Saturday morning or whatever it's been. And but yeah, it's part of your job, it's part of your life, and I've really enjoyed it. And I've also enjoyed the odd occasion I've been able to go to the Commonwealth Games and the Ireland Games, which are superb events, really are. And you know, to see the Isle of Man as a team, as an island, competing on the international stage, I've seen some really proud moments there, from Mark Cavendish's first international win in Guernsey in 2003 to the Crowe brothers. You know, what they did and what they've done the last 2 years at the TT has been phenomenal, and I'm very proud to have seen them in their very first races to on the top step of the podium. So that's it. Just covers a wide span of people and ages. Another one is Yasmin Ingham, you know, world event champion, you know, eventing champion. Those people, they make it all worthwhile, because, you know, they're nice people too, and it's always great to be to get to meet them and to interview them, and just feel as if you're a little bit of part of the team, sort of thing. That's the way it's been over the years, and I'm very proud to have been that.
Hi, my name's Stephen Quilliam, ringing from Northumberland. Well, I feel very surprised, taken aback, really. And, of course, it came at the same time as one of my close school friends getting it as well, John Watterson.
Yes, John Watterson. So,
yeah, Watty, yes. Yeah.
So, did you guys go to school together?
Yeah, we went to Cloth Workers together, went to Douglas High School together. We used to go every Friday to see Black Mass playing at the Dougie Head. And he had his Morris car. We used to pile in and go every Friday to the Dougie Head. Yeah.
Where were you when you got the news that you were going to be recognised with this award?
Well, I was in my house, and it came as a letter. Quite a few weeks ago, because you get a letter from the Cabinet Office, and I saw this posh-looking envelope with posh paper, and I thought it might have been something unpleasant, but it was actually a very pleasant letter indeed, asking if I would want to be, would you accept an honour? Yeah. So I replied and said yes, and then I was told, don't do anything else, keep quiet about it, and you'll hear from us at some stage. And then I got a nice phone call about a week ago from somebody, a lovely lady from the Cabinet Office, just to confirm everything was going through and it was okay to release the information to the press.
And did it come as a surprise? Were you expecting it, or had any kind of inkling?
No, none. Complete surprise.
So, remind us what it is exactly that you've been recognised for.
I have been a GP in the the ex-coal mining town of Prudder, here in the Tyne Valley on the beautiful River Tyne, since 1986. And it being a relatively deprived area then, it's much better now, I quickly realised there were a lot of health problems that needed sorting out, and we did some various what you might call then what we call groundbreaking changes, such as getting a computer. Would you believe it? That was one of them. Also working together as a team of health professionals, because prior to that, GPs and health visitors and district nurses tended to work on their own, but we formed a team, and we concentrated on some of the health issues of the time, particularly heart disease and diabetes and the likes. Further developed IT. For instance, there was the magic day when all our prescriptions came out in a printed form as opposed to being laboriously handwritten. That was a magic day. And also using the computer to do health screening, such as cancer screening for smears for cervical cancer. We were able to communicate more effectively with our population, and we had very high levels of smear uptake as a consequence. And then as the years went by and we moved to a new premises, we built a new surgery, we worked together with all the colleagues in the area. I'd have to say Tynedale is a similar population size to the Isle of Man, so it was a bit like getting all the Manx GPs together and dealing with common health issues, and in our case working more closely with secondary care, with hospitals, doing some of the more of the hospital work. So it was all about improving communication and working together, and I think that's what I was recommended for with the honours. But also I was about to go on my retirement holiday in 2021, I think it was, not 2020, because COVID started in December 2019. I was going to go on, my wife says it was 2020. We're about to go on my retirement holiday to the Caribbean, my holiday of a lifetime in my retirement, but cancelled it, of course, because of COVID. And then I stayed on for about another 18 months doing vaccinations and consultations and during this very worrying time for us all. So that's how it seemed to have happened. But also, I was doing lots of music as well. I play the trombone. I used to play in the Manx Youth Band. That's how I started when I was 11. I used to have brass lessons from Mr. Crosby, who was the conductor then, played in the Manx Youth Band, played in the Douglastown Band, played in the Manx Youth Orchestra at that time. So I carried on with my music as a student, and then up here, playing trombone, formed the Prudder Community Band up here with two other people, one of whom is our conductor. And all my kids played in the community band, and since then we've kept the band going. We keep music live. We've been playing at various events since then. We're about to play at Newcastle Railway Station this Saturday, for instance. So I think that summarises it.
So very varied. And I suppose if I pick up on the first part of your career to start off with then, and were you one of the first surgeries to be introducing these kind of practices within the GP?
Yes, we were. It might seem just ordinary nowadays, but we really felt strongly how useful IT could be. So I used to go to conferences learning more about it, and I suppose I was one of the drivers, along with my partner at the time, to help enable other practices to adopt IT. Yeah, so that was one of the things. The other thing is we were a training practice, so that's training doctors to be GPs. So we in Tynedale, worked very closely with all the other training practices because we wanted to make sure that general practice was recognised as a really good profession to go in. In effect, we wanted to be thought of in the same level as consultants in hospital. In fact, we're consultants in family medicine. As a consequence, many GP doctors at the time were attracted to working in general practice rather than hospital medicine. I think we were helping boost the GP population of the area.
And you talked about deferring your retirement as a result of COVID.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Can you just give me your experience of what the pandemic was like from a medical perspective and from your perspective as a GP within the community?
Yes. Well, it was very... Well, I was very frightened, I would have to say that. And I had an additional reason for this. By an amazing coincidence, we were in the city of Bergamo in Italy in December 2019. 2 weeks later, the first case of COVID appeared in Europe, in Bergamo. And because I kept an eye on Italian medical practice, because I have a long love of Italy, I was noticing that doctors and nurses were dying in Bergamo as they were heroically trying to deal with a terrible number of deaths there. And I thought, this is going to be very serious indeed. So I sort of had a background information, and I was getting very, very frustrated at the time that the United Kingdom government was being so slow in responding to this, because we had been waiting for a pandemic to happen. We thought it was going to be influenza, not this new virus. I was very concerned indeed, and certainly by January, I was terrified, and I wanted particularly our politicians at the time to act far more swiftly than they did. That was how I felt at the time.
And what was it like still having to go to work and going and treating patients, and when you are that scared and you are that frightened of what's going on?
Well, you have to. We took all the precautions we had by protecting ourselves with gloves and masks and everything. We were trying to contact the most vulnerable people that we thought were the high risk, such as the learning disabled, people who are immunocompromised, wanting to communicate with them about how safe they need to be, but with very limited, there was no treatment at that time, of course. So it was about trying to reduce risk, and simple things, washing your hands was one of the most important messages that you could convey. There were very uncertain times, of course, because nobody knew whether masks were worthwhile. What was going to happen to the things like going to school, buses, the police. So it was about bracing ourselves at the time. But of course, it's still seeing people who had other health issues, because that still happened, of course. So we were just very careful, and we would only allow people to come down to the surgery for very good reasons, so we had to screen who was allowed to come to the surgery without increasing risk to everybody.
So is it possible to put into words then what it means to you to get the BM, to get the BEM and to get that recognition?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm just totally flattered, really. I can't say any more than that. I need to thank the people, whoever they are, because, of course, your nominees are secret. So, but you'll find out. I'll find out by asking directly, I suppose. So it would have been my work colleagues, but also my musical friends as well, who presumably would have nominated me. So it means a great deal. And of course, all this time I've had the support of my lovely wife, Jo, and my four children.
And I have to ask, how did you celebrate?
How did I celebrate on it? Let's see. I think I probably made myself a nice cup of tea.
The true British way to celebrate.
Yes, it is, isn't it? I never forget my Manx roots. That's the first thing. And we travel, go over to the islands as often as we can. Got my two sisters there. Alas, my mum died last year. She lived in Peel. And my dad a few years ago, Leslie, who had the honour of receiving an RBV for his work with Manx culture, having written some books on Manx surnames and place names. So, I still want to keep my Manx connections going. And my children visit the island as well, and with their surname being as it is, you can never escape Manxness.
I'm Karen Norton. I was completely overwhelmed. I was lost for words, and I shed a tear or two. I couldn't make sense of it, really.
And we get given a biography of all of the people who receive honours, and yours just is an entire A4 page of all of the things that you have done, from being a primary school teacher specialising in supporting children with additional needs to founding Cafe Lingo, helping over 500 people from 48 different countries develop their language skills and find a way to connect with island life, and then playing a key role in welcoming Ukrainian families fleeing the war since 2022. I mean, the list just goes on and on and on. Does it feel a bit surreal seeing it all like that?
Well, it is surreal, because you go through your life, don't you? You do what you do, and you do a lot of it because of the response of other people, and you don't analyse it in that way. And it looks rather nice when it's written down.
So let me talk a little bit then about Cafe Lingo. So Tell me, for those who haven't come across it, what is Cafe Lingo?
It's a support group for people who come to the island whose first language is not English. And the idea of it is to welcome them and to help them to feel at home, to teach them English, to not worry about whether they're, you know, what nationality they have, what faith they have, how old they are, what gender they are, what faith. It's that they've come through the door, and our job is to welcome them, but also to equip them for integrating into island life. Some of them arrive on Cafe Lingo's doorstep with an English degree, maybe. Others have no English at all. And for all of them, it's a challenge, because it's not just the language, but that's an important part, because it opens the door to so many things. But it's how the island works, what the culture is, how to find things out, And it's to do with official things, you know, signposting to correct departments and correct charities. But it's also the other aspects of island life that if you're brought up here, you just take for granted. Like nicknames of places, like aspects of culture, you know, like saying hello to the fairies and things, hunting the red, things like that. And it's to sort of open the door to them so they can see what whole island life is like.
Because that's the thing with the Isle of Man, isn't it? Even if you have spent your life living in the UK and you come to the Isle of Man, it's still a bit of a culture shock because the island is so unique. So then when you take that with then the added barrier of a language, a different language to throw into that, it can be quite a daunting place. It can potentially be quite lonely, I'd imagine.
I think loneliness is a common factor there. Quite often people come over here and regardless of their level of qualifications, they can end up doing jobs with antisocial hours. For instance, quite a lot of them may end up as cleaners, cleaning officers overnight. Who do they talk to? You know, and there is either no one to talk to or there's no one to practice their English with, and no one to socialise. How do they get to meet new people? It can be relatively easy to talk to people of their own language in the street if they happen to see them. But how do they learn? How do they develop relationships with the wider community, with other people? So the social aspect of cafe lingua, in my mind, was always 50%. It was 50% teaching English, learning English, and 50% it was a social thing.
What gave you the idea to set up Cafe Lingo and what inspired you?
Well, I had been a teacher, but we had retired. We retired on the same day and went off to Portugal the following Monday and had a lovely time. And then we came home when our granddaughter was on the way, because family matters such a lot to us. And I think it was having been to Portugal as a foreigner and been welcomed there, coming home and seeing little groups of people in the street who only ever seemed to be talking to the same people, you know, whenever you went into Strand Street, and also in shops other than supermarkets, struggling to ask questions, struggling to understand the answers. And also I was hearing stories about people going to the doctors, for instance, middle-aged women or older women having to take male children with them to interpret at the doctors. I was thinking, this is not good, you know, that it's not good for the dignity of a person either, really. But because I was happy and retired and we were having a great time, I didn't want to get involved, really. But Elaine Christian, who's a JP, member of Trinity Church, she was at a joint meeting with Promenade Church, and she said very similar things. And I thought, I've got to do something about this because my professional background has given me certain skills to enable me to do something. So a little bit reluctantly, really, I embarked on it. But Promenade Church, they sponsored me getting trained to teach English as a foreign language, because although I had quite a few professional qualifications and experience, I'd never actually done that. And then people from Promenade and Trinity congregations showed a willingness to become involved. So we put posters up all over the island, didn't we? And we got a fantastic group of volunteers, and many of them are still there now. But like I was trying to say there, that Cafe Lingo grew because of the way people responded, because of the way the volunteers responded. They were giving up their Saturday mornings to sit alongside foreign people who they didn't know initially and help them go through language activities and help to explain where Ramsey was, or, you know, where the ferry bridge is, or something like that. And it was because of them, but it was also because of the response of other people, like the emergency services. The emergency services were great because there had been an incident at Germain Road previously where there'd been a fire and a language problem for communicating. So the fire brigade, they were wonderful, and the police, and you know, that the response from them was so positive and helpful, and it became an annual event to invite them in, and they would give me words to begin with, the key words they wanted to go over, and then I would pre-teach them so that the students had some idea of the meaning of those words, and then they would talk to the students. Students is a funny word, but we never knew what to call them because it became like a family. And then they had the chance to ask questions or to talk privately with a member of the emergency services to discuss something that was bothering them. So they were fantastic. And other organisations like the Deaf Society, the Art Society, the police force, of course, and just all these different people were coming in when we invited them and contributing. And I don't know, it just kept on growing. When it came to Ukraine, it was all a new situation over here, I think. As far as I was concerned, it was. And we thought, well, Cafe Lingo actually is an organisation already set up with a lovely group of volunteers, and we're already used to people who don't speak English or don't speak it very well, and maybe we can be useful in that situation. But how do we get involved? So I contacted the Cabinet Office, and they were very positive in the way they responded. And we developed what I consider a very close relationship with the Ukraine support team, who were amazing. And if I came across some sort of problem or issue that I didn't quite know what to do about, I would contact them and they would feedback to me. Or if I thought I knew something that perhaps they needed to know, I would feed it to them. So that's how that developed. And also the One World Centre, they were fantastic. You know, they helped support our response to it. So when the first largest group of Ukrainians came over with the One World Centre, we organised a lesson and brunch. It was an orientation lesson because some of them actually didn't know that they were in the Isle of Man, and they didn't know, others didn't know where the Isle of Man was. And others had heard of it but didn't know anything about it. So we had an orientation lesson and a brunch, which was provided by the One World Centre. And it was a welcome. And people still talk about it. And, you know, it was their impression of the Isle of Man was this community and being welcomed and being fed, you know. And it evolved. And the other thing I remember from that time really was that Tim was watching the television. There was a programme about the Rucksack Project, where the author of Bob the Builder had written the Rucksack book, which became dual language, English and Ukrainian. And it was to tell the story of children who'd had to flee from Ukraine. And I won't spoil the message of it, but it ended up with hope. And because of Tim watching this, we decided we need to give every Ukrainian child refugee a copy of this book. And because of this, the charity Children in War UK got in touch with us, and it ended up with a Zoom within Zoom session one Sunday afternoon, didn't it, where there was psychiatrist who could speak Ukrainian and psychologists coming in on Zoom to support carers and refugees. And at the same time, the children were being read the story by the author over Zoom upstairs, translated or interpreted by Luba and Oksana, both of whom were Ukrainians. Luba was actually a refugee as well. And they both had very good English. So they were interpreting it. And then the illustrator came in within the Zoom. And she was in Ukraine, in a cellar. And the sketches of the illustrations for the book were behind her. And it was such an opportunity for emotional outpouring for the children, really. It was a real support for them. She brought her dog, and this golden Labrador was there. And they all, I don't know, somehow it was like therapy, really. And that's, I remember that, oh dear, making Tim cry. Because it was very moving, because so many were traumatised, you know. But because of our circumstances, we were only keeping going for as long as we felt the Ukrainians needed it, because for health reasons, we needed to stop. So last year, we actually retired from Cafe Lingo, and we were so lucky to find two people to take it on. That was Sharon Jones, and Sylvie Gell-Wilkes, who are now running it. And we have contact, like if any information's needed. And also I'm the safeguarding officer still, so I'm there doing that. But basically now we've handed it over, but I believe all the volunteers are still there, and they're getting new volunteers and new people. So it's just going from strength to strength.
But what an amazing legacy to have, to know that you have directly impacted the experience of all people of another language coming to the Isle of Man, but particularly those who have been through horrendous times and fleeing from the war in their home country. And you've actually helped make them be able to feel like they can have a new home here while they need it. I mean, that's an incredible feat.
Well, it was a sense of family, really, that we Cafe Lingo became like a family, and people were supporting each other. It didn't require me there all the time to orchestrate that, and they just bonded. But the surprise that came to me was that as a teacher, you sort of expect to be giving out a lot, and you don't expect to necessarily be getting back. But it was the wonderful relationships were built by. We met so many lovely people. So it wasn't just a one-way process, that hopefully they were benefiting. They were benefiting from Cafe Lingo, and not just us, but from all the volunteers and from the atmosphere. We kept on being told about the atmosphere there, and from each other. It was a place to support each other. But we got a lot from it as well, didn't we? Yeah.
So when it comes to the BEM then, what message do you think that sends to recognise you for the work that you've been doing with those, like with that part of the community?
I think it gives a message that people coming to the island are welcome, and we should actively welcome them and encourage them, because it's not only that we give them something, they give us something back, either through their talents or just the people that they are and the joy that they can bring. And they're part of our community now, and we want that to be a strong and caring community that's tolerant. And I think that's all I can say, really.
And I have to ask everybody this. How did you celebrate when you found out?
What did we do? I think we spent the rest of the day being completely baffled. And
Well, you were on a cruise at the time.
We were on a cruise at the time. And it was a whole roller coaster of emotions as to this, because we were overwhelmed, weren't we? Yeah. And I don't know. I think we sort of tried to carry on with what the sort of things we've been doing on the cruise, like going for lovely meals and watching wonderfully talented people on the stage. But we weren't quite with it, were we? And the difficult part of it was that we weren't allowed to tell anyone, not even our children, even though the message received that, which wasn't a clear message at all. It was just that I had to phone Government House, but and it was something to do with Andy and a nomination, my nephew Andy, but we couldn't actually talk to them about it. And that was so hard, not being able to share with them. And they obviously knew something was going on, but we couldn't answer any questions.
So when the press release went live at 10:30 on Friday night, did you get an angry call from your kids going, what's this about? Why didn't we know about this?
Well, no, because our daughter, who amazingly works at Rebecca House, she was on a night shift. And our son actually works for Island Man newspapers, and he'd seen the press release and ahead, you know, so he already knew before we But I think both of them understand the need for discretion, and they both understand confidentiality. Mm. So I don't think they were too cross with
us. And we went out for a meal the next
day. Yeah, we did. Yeah. We went out for two meals, actually, didn't we? The next day. We went out for one with our nephew Andy, who sort of coordinated everything. He'd led it, the application really, him and his family, for lunch. And then we went out with our children, the grandchildren, and our daughter's partner for tea. So, oh dear.
So you celebrated well.
We did. And then it was Father's Day. So we had to celebrate again.
So, is it possible to put into words what the recognition means to you?
I just think it's amazing. I think it's so wonderful that ordinary people have been recognised, really, and honoured in this way. But also, it doesn't just recognise us. It recognises all the lovely people that have become involved. And it says something about the Manx community, you know, and what our values as a community are. I know there are some people who wouldn't agree with it, but what I think are the main cultural values of our community, what they are, it reminds us that we are a small island, but we can look outwards, we can welcome people in. And I think it just encourages us, really, to do things like that, because there are so many people out there doing so many wonderful things, aren't there?
Thank you for making it to the end of the Manx Radio newscast. You are obviously someone with exquisite taste. May I politely suggest you might want to subscribe to this and a wide range of Manx Radio podcasts at your favourite podcast provider, so our best bits will magically appear on your smartphone. Thank you.